We believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. I want to congratulate Mike for passing that first year mark. And it's been a little while, but I'm going to have his sponsor, Tinsley E., come up and introduce him to the group here.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And the guy that's speaking tonight is not only my sponsor, but he's my good friend. And I wonder if he knows how much he helps me. And, you know, going through the steps together and stuff like that. But I'm not going to tell you how he does it. He does the deal, I'll tell you that much. We'll let him tell you how he does it. But with that, I'm going to give you my...
Good evening, everybody. My name's Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. For that matter, I'm glad to be anywhere. You know, I stole that line of a guy that I see come around here all the time, and I really, you know, am glad to be here, and I am glad to be anywhere. You know, it wasn't always the case for me, because I've been around to a lot of places, and but I never really was quite really there. You know, my body might have been there, but my mind was off somewhere else. So, you know, when I say that, I really mean it, man. I'm really glad to be here, glad to be anywhere. If I were to sum up my life, it would be comprised of two lists. One list would be things that I did that I shouldn't have done, and the other one would be things that I didn't do that I should have done. There are a lot of things on each one of those lists. Today, though, I try and compile a third list, and that list is things that I do that I should do. You know, and there. That wasn't always the case with me. You know, I did a lot of stuff that I shouldn't have done, shouldn't have done, you know, and it didn't work out too well. You know, I had the privilege of sobering up in Canada in the early 90s, and part of the meeting formats up there is when you chair a meeting, you have to qualify before you, start the proceedings. And so I got to thinking, you know, what qualifies me as an alcoholic? And I got out a piece of paper, and I started drinking, and this is the way I would qualify myself as an alcoholic. I started drinking in roughly around 1970 or so. You know, I was a late bloomer. I didn't, you know, start when I was a kid, or even I didn't even start when I was in high school. You know, it wasn't until I got into college that I really got going with it. And so that roughly is 40 years of drinking and drugging. That's a long time. But I got to put the pen to it, and I figured in the last 10 or maybe 12, 13 years that I was drinking, I drank 1,350 gallons of vodka. I mean, that's a lot, you know, 1,350. That's enough to maybe fill up a bathtub or float a small boat or whatever, but that's a lot. Not only that, but I spent roughly $14,000 on vodka. That's a lot of money. You know, that's a going rate around here, and that doesn't include bars and, you know, that kind of thing. You know, I never was really much of a bar drinker. You know, I found it a lot more economical just to get a bottle and sit home, you know. So, anyway, I went to my first treatment center in 1985. And over the course of 85 to roughly 2008, I was in 7 treatment centers. 3 of them I went through twice, which makes a grand total of 10 times, you know, that I was involved in some kind of treatment program or whatever. And I found, you know, my experience in treatment programs was it's a good education, you know, about the disease of alcoholism, and you learn a lot, you know, about the effects, you know, that alcohol has on your mind and your body. And but I also learned that there was no cure to it. You know, we have a fatal disease that there's no cure to. And you know, I don't know whether any of you guys ever see those commercials on TV for a place called Passages Malibu. You know, they say, you know, the guy says, "I'm Paxton. I used to be an alcoholic and or addict, and now I'm not." You know, this is not a 12-step program. You know, this works. And you know, maybe I missed something along the lines. You know, maybe there is a cure that I just don't know about. And you know, I'm not. You know, maybe that type of a situation would work for some people. And you know, I do know that if you pay $16 plus $6 shipping and handling, you can have a book that will, you know, cure your alcoholism and addiction. So, you know, for people that, you know, might get sober or get clean that way, then more power to them, you know. But I never, you know, I can't imagine there being a cure for this disease. So, you know, treatment centers for me was a good education for me to learn about what's going on with the disease. And, you know, I didn't realize for a long time that this really was a disease, man, you know, and it's fatal. You know, it's going to kill me if I keep on doing it. What really brought me to AA seriously, you know, I went to my first AA meeting in 1984-85, and it wasn't really till I got up around 1990 or so that I got serious about AA. But the first meeting I went to, I can remember I was in a treatment center, Charter Beachwood, and this was, you know, way back when it really was Charter Beachwood. You know, I think it's gone through several hands since then. But first AA meeting I ever went to, you know, I went because, you know, that was part of the deal there. You had to go, and I went to it, and I listened, and I just couldn't really make any sense about what was going on. You know, I didn't think none of that applied to me. And as a result of that, I think I lasted about maybe 3 or 4 days at Charter, and I just packed up my stuff and walked out the front door, you know, and continued doing what I was doing, which was getting high whenever I wanted to do, get drunk whatever I wanted to do, whenever I wanted to, and just doing basically what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. But what really brought me to AA seriously was, you know, the story in chapter in the big book, A Vision for You, you know, talks about Four Horsemen and the terror, bewilderment, you know, frustration and despair. And it also talks about the chilling vapor of loneliness that only an alcoholic can understand. And, you know, when I, during the last, you know, a few weeks or a few months of my drinking career, I really felt like I was the loneliest person on the face of the earth. You know, I didn't have any friends anymore. Nobody wanted to be around me. You know, what family I had left, you know, I was living with my son at the time at a hotel, and he would go out every night, and he didn't want to be there, you know. So I just spent every day in that hotel room just drinking. And that was all I knew how to do, really. I didn't know how to cope with life on any kind of meaningful terms. So I just drank, man, you know. And I I was never the kind of alcoholic, you know, you hear people talk about going out and buying a 12-pack of beer and drinking a 12-pack and or buying, you know, a bottle of vodka and then just drinking it and going out and spending every waking moment, you know, finding another bottle or whatever. And, you know, I was never that kind of drunk, but I would always make sure to save a little bit, you know, for the next day. And the problem I had was that there was always a next day. You know, I would always wind up getting drunk again the next day. I don't know whether it was out of boredom or because I didn't feel like I had anything else to do, but I knew I was very lonely, very, very lonely. And so I drank every day. You know, I became comfortable in my misery, I guess, you know, is the way I could put it, to where that was all I knew how to do, you know. And so that's what I did every day. And I never really was a morning drinker, but there towards the end of my career, I found myself walking up to the liquor store, you know, at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, waiting outside for them to open. And I, you know, I did that. I never really had the DTs or anything like that, although at the end, you know, I was probably getting a little shaky, you know, in the mornings. That's what it was like for me. That's what, you know, brought me into AA. You know, I mean, it was a horrible way of life. You know, it really was. And I can remember in that hotel room praying to God, whatever God there may or may not be, you know, to put me out of my misery. You know, I really didn't want to wake up. You know, it was horrible. I just didn't, you know, I'd reached that jumping off point that the book talks about where I couldn't live with it, I couldn't live without it. And it was horrible. And I didn't really realize it at the time, but about 4 or 5 days after later, you know, a guy from, and I'm going to mention a group's name here, a guy from Complete Abandon Group showed up, and I met him over at Triangle, and he was there, and he took me to an AA meeting. And so I can honestly say that if that guy hadn't showed up, I probably wouldn't be sober today, you know. So I owe a debt of gratitude to that group in particular. You know, I spent 4 or 5 months participating in that group, and then I eventually wound up leaving and joining my home group here at NAVA, which is actually the Tuesday night beginners meeting, which is my home group here. There's only two members in the group right now, and I see one of them sitting over there now. But, you know, if anybody wants to join a good group, you know, you can come on out. That's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. I've been a member of that group. You know, my sobriety date is August 10th, 2010. So I've been sober a year and nine. Next week I'll have a year and 9 months. But that whole year and 9 months, I've been a member of that group, and I've been coming to this particular meeting here every Monday night for the whole time that I've been sober too, you know. And it feels odd standing up here, you know, telling my story, because I usually come in here and set the PA up and sign the meeting sheets back there every week, and, you know, participate, you know, in whatever way I can, you know, in the program. And that's one of the ways that I've been able to maintain my sobriety. Anyway, I'm really grateful to Complete Abandon Group for that. You know, that they're kind of controversial sometimes and whatever, but they were there for me when I needed it, and they gave me a place to stay. And like I said, I eventually left that group and, you know, came back up here in NAVA and joined the Tuesday night beginners meeting. So I guess I'm sort of a de facto member of this group, you know, so to speak, because I, you know, I've been here, you know, every Monday night for the last year and 9 months. But anyway, a brief history of my growing up years, you know, there's nothing remarkable about my early years. You know, I was brought up and raised by a mom and dad who were very loving, very caring. I didn't, you know, experience any kind of abuse or anything like that. You know, I was born in Hattiesburg, Mississippi on September 11th, 1950. And it turns out that September 11th is a very famous birthday to have these days after what happened to the World Trade Centers. But anyway, after I was born in Hattiesburg, I think I only stayed there for a couple of years, and then my dad moved around a lot. He was a salesman, and later on to become a sales executive for Universal Motion Pictures. I'm sure you've all heard of Universal Pictures, you know. But over the next, I guess, till the time I got into elementary school and junior high school, I lived in New Orleans for a little while, and I lived in Mobile, Alabama, which is where my brother was born, and then I lived in St. Louis, Missouri, you know, for 7 or 8 years, and St. Louis was where I went to, you know, junior high, and started in on high school, so after I got into high school there, my dad was transferred, and you know, we moved around a lot. You know, that was part of his job, you know, required us to move. You know, every year or two we'd be moving around, even within a city. You know, we would always live in a different neighborhood or whatever, so it, you know, it wasn't like that I didn't feel like I never fit in. I feel kind of like I never was given time enough to fit in, you know, because every time I would get comfortable, you know, where I was or whatever, we'd have to pack up and move to another city or to another neighborhood or whatever. So that was kind of the way it was like for me, you know, when I was growing up. When I was in high school, my first year of high school, my dad got transferred out to Los Angeles, and so I went out to Los Angeles and went through high school in Los Angeles, and you know, during the time I was in school, you know, back in those days, you were either a jock or a greaser. You know, at least that's the way that the way we referred to it back then. And I was very much the jock type of guy. You know, I was very involved in athletics, football, you know, track. You know, I was captain of the football team and all the second team, all city LA. And I set the shot put record, you know, at my high school and so on. So I was much more into that, really, than I was drinking and using. And as a matter of fact, I was I was successful enough at my football, you know, career that I got letters of intent from quite a few well-known colleges around the United States. A few of them were like Notre Dame, Southern Cal, UCLA, Georgia. You know, they were all interested in, you know, and having me play football for them. And so the only problem was that my grades weren't good enough. So everybody said, well, go to a junior college and you bring your grades up, and then we'll talk to you, you know. And so that's what I did. I went to L.A. Valley Junior College, and that was where I discovered the frat parties, you know. And that turned out to be, where I really got into my drinking and drugging career. you know, the first semester I was there, my grades were fine. But after that, it was like hell in a handbasket. You know, I discovered frat parties. You know, I can't really remember the first time I ever got drunk. But I was pretty much a blackout drinker, you know, from the get-go. You know, and it was also there at LA Valley that I had discovered marijuana. And by the way, I'm going to have to mention some drugs in my story, because that's just part of my story, you know. But anyway, I discovered marijuana and started drinking there. And about this time when I was in college out there, I met my future first wife, and I was a star on the football team, and she was captain of the drill team, you know, and the, you know, pom-pom girls and all that, and she would, you know, go on to become my first wife, and I loved her very, very much, and, you know, we which is the quintessential, you know, loving couple there on campus. And so we got married. And during this period of time, I also went to work for Universal Pictures myself. You know, I never really wanted to be like my dad. I mean, the household I grew up in, mom and dad were, it's not up to me to say whether they're alcoholic or not, but I know my dad drank every day. You know, he had bottles hidden around the house. You know, and we used to joke, my brother and I used to joke, you know, Dad's got a hollow leg, because, you know, we never would really see him drunk or anything. Now, my mom, she was, I think, a quarter or half Choctaw Indian, so she was the kind of drunk that she would get a couple of drinks in her, and she would become the meanest, orneriest bitch you would ever want to know, really. You know, she did not handle her liquor really very well at all. And, you know, you wanted to be liked by her, but you sure didn't want her to hate you, because, you know, once you got on her bad side, you know, it was bad. I mean, she was really very, very mean and ornery and stuff. And I can remember Dad, they'd go out drinking, and I would invariably get a call on the phone, man. Dad, Mike, man, your mom's acting up. You got to come down here and get her, you know, get her out of here, which I would do. And she was just very ornery, you know, and I suspect that they were both, you know, alcoholic. You know, my dad was sober the last 15 or so years of his life, but he never, he never practiced any principles of the program. He didn't know what AA was. I mean, he just quit. You know, my sister killed somebody in a car accident, and she was drunk. And once that happened, my dad just swore off liquor, and that was it for him. I mean, he literally went 15 years and just never took another drink. You know, unfortunately, I couldn't do that. So anyway, I went to work for Universal Motion Pictures in the early 70s, you know, after I was married. And part of that, you know, that job was not in the beginning, you know, but well, first of all, after I went to work for them in LA, I got transferred up to Seattle, Washington. And and after I was in Seattle for a while, I got transferred to Des Moines, Iowa. And the whole time I was kind of working my way up the ladder at the company. But, you know, once I got to Des Moines, I really realized, you know, once I got into the sales department as opposed to the booking department, you know, I really realized how much I hated that job. And it involved too much bullshit and stuff, and I just didn't like it. But, you know, I was married, and you know, I needed the job. You know, I had a company car, and we got out there to Iowa. We bought a house, you know, and I went through the motions, I guess you could say. But you know, one thing about that job, and one thing that always bothered me about it, was that I, you know, my dad by this time was a successful sales executive at Universal, and I always never was really quite sure whether every promotion I got was because I was his son, or whether it was something that I deserved, you know. And that kind of plagued me, you know, during my whole career with Universal. There's, you know, an event happened there in Des Moines that really changed my life forever. I was, you know, at work one day and stayed late, and I was, you know, probably high. I can't really remember, but stayed late and was on my way home, and I heard a radio on the radio that there had been an accident, you know, on the freeway there in Des Moines, and if at all possible, you know, find some kind of detour route, which I did. And when I got home, there was a strange car parked in the driveway, and next thing I know, you know, I parked in front of the house, and then a guy comes running up to me, and I rolled down the window, and he asked me, "Are you Michael Dunn?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he says, "Well, I'm R.C. Wooters, the coroner for Polk County, Iowa, and I hate to have to tell you this, but your wife and little girl have been killed in a car crash." And also, you know, she was 9 months pregnant at the time, too, so it was actually a wife and two kids that were killed in this car crash. And, you know, as it turned out, you know, the accident that I heard about on the radio was where they had been killed. And so that was an experience I will never forget. You know, the moment I found that out, you know, it's kind of like seared in my mind, you know. And that was June 2nd, 1980, and the anniversary is coming up here. I think the 32-year anniversary is coming up June 2nd of this year. And, you know, I always have a hard time, you know, around that time of year, because it, you know, that's just seared in my mind, you know, finding that out. You know, it was headline news in the Des Moines Register the next day, pictures of the burned out hulk of the car, and you know, it was just horrible, man. I had reporters calling me wanting to know how I felt, you know, or, you know, wanting me to just talk, and they wanted to know how I felt about all that. And thank God for me, we had a family friend named Jeff, and he had just graduated from the Drake Law School, which is a university there in Iowa, and or Des Moines, and he came over to the house and started taking care of the phone calls and, you know, putting out press releases or whatever. And you know, it was just horrible, man. You know, I still, you know, have a hard time thinking about that, you know. But anyway, the lawyer, they hired a law, you know, an investigator, so that we could find out exactly what happened. And you know, it turns out that this truck was coming around a curve on the freeway and going too fast, and he just couldn't stop and kind of fishtailed into the back of their car, which was a Mercury Capri. I don't know whether you guys are familiar with the Ford Pinto cases of that time, but it wasn't a Ford Pinto, but it was a Mercury Capri, which is the same frame and all that stuff. So anyway, this truck, you know, rear-ended him, and the whole car just blew up. You know, poof, you know, here 1 minute, you know, next, gone the next. And anyway, the law firm, my lawyer friend, you know, and the law firm, we hired an investigator, you know, to find out exactly what happened. And, you know, we found out that there was some defect in the gas tank of the car, and, you know, and what this guy was going too fast. And, you know, we found out what we thought, you know, was the cause of this whole thing. And so about three or four months after the accident actually happened, we filed a wrongful death lawsuit in the amount of $70 million. A $70 million wrongful death lawsuit. And so that was hard to take, man. You know, when I, which we eventually wound up, you know, 4 or 5 years later, settling that lawsuit out of court, you know, and we settled that lawsuit. Now, you know, I've never really mentioned figures, you know, specifically before, but we settled that lawsuit for, you know, $1,700,000. And that's a lot of money, man. You know, and it kind of haunted me. I guess haunted, you know, it was food for thought for me to think about, you know, there are people, you know, how do you put a price on life, man? I mean, what is a human life worth? And who decides that, you know? And there are people, you know, lawyers and insurance agents and that, you know, that's what they do. I mean, they have, you know, I don't know what the technical name for them is, actuaries or something like that, but they, you know, I just had a hard time dealing with the fact that here's this beautiful woman and two kids killed, and here's somebody sitting in some room somewhere flipping open a book going, let's see, female, 30 years old, you know, young infant, you know, 2 years old, 30-year-old female, pregnant female, you know. So they have charts, you know, where they decide how much a life is worth. You know, I probably could have, if I wanted to, you know, let that lawsuit go to court, I probably could have gotten a lot more money. But the lawyers were afraid, you know, I was well into my drinking and drugging career at the time, and they didn't want me to be investigated. They didn't want anybody to find out, you know, what my true history really was. So, anyway, we settled that, you know, out of court. And, you know, as of today, you know, like I said, we settled that for $1,700,000. And fortunately for me, the way the lawsuit was structured, I would get X amount of dollars every month, which has been very helpful to me, you know, because I still receive that today, and that's part of what I, you know, support myself with. You know, I don't work, I'm retired, quote unquote, or whatever, you know, but I, you know, I don't work. And then the way this thing was structured, every 5 years, I would get, you know, a big chunk of cash, you know, and it started out at $25,000, and it went up to $50,000, and it went up to $100,000, and that has gone on right up until, I think in 2014, I will get the final big chunk of cash, and it's a lot of money, man, a whole lot of money. And I hate to say that throughout the years, over the years, I mean, every penny of all that money that I ever got, I blew that on drugs and alcohol. Particularly the drugs part, they're a lot more expensive than alcohol is. But anyway, I blew it all. You know, I blew all of it, was blown, man. I blew every penny. And it was hard for me to deal with because, you know, I kind of felt like it was dirty money, like I didn't deserve it. So I've had people tell me, well, that's why you know, had no compulsion about spending it or blowing it or whatever. But it was very difficult, you know, and Another problem I had dealing with that that accident thing was, you know, I have a son today, he's 26, 20, 27 years old, who just, him and his girlfriend just had a baby, so which makes me a grandfather. And, you know, would I have my son today? Would I have a granddaughter today if that wife hadn't been killed? You know, I since married another woman. You know, so it's just a real hard thing to reconcile in your own mind. You know? Would I have the family I have today if the family I used to have wasn't killed, which I'm getting all this money for? And I've had a hard time dealing with that, you know, the whole time since that accident happened 32 years ago. Anyway, I came back to, after that accident happened, I moved back to Atlanta, and I moved in with my parents, and I was living in Decatur at the time, and or Stone Mountain, actually. And there was a bar that I used to love to go to, you know, called Hemingway's there in Decatur, and there was a band that played there every Monday and Tuesday night. And I used to love to go hear that band. You know, the regular house band was Ron Kimball and Ron Kimball, but this other band that played every Monday and Tuesday night was called Chicago Bob and the Heart Fixers. And I really loved that kind of music, you know, and I loved in particular the guy playing guitar for Chicago Bob and the Heart Fixers. He was really just kind of a wild and crazy guy, you know, and I really kind of suspected that he was messed up and high and drinking. I mean, he was drinking all the time he played, you know, and he was probably high on coke too, you know. I mean, he had to be. You know, but if you'd have told me then that 25 years ago that very same guy would become my sponsor in AA, and he's sitting right back there, I think he introduced me. You know, so I'm real, you know, 20, you know, God works in mysterious ways. You know, I don't know whether it was God thing, or coincidence, or whatever, but. He's my sponsor today. He's actually been my sponsor twice. The first time he was my sponsor, I did what a lot of us do. I just kind of dropped off the face of the earth, and, you know, I didn't do what I needed to do and stuff, and I quit showing up. And fortunately, you know, when I came back around a second time, you know, he agreed to be my sponsor again, and I've been working with him, you know, ever since. He's been real, real good for me. You know, he doesn't manage my life for me, but he gives me a good insight into the program. You know, he's the first sponsor I ever had that actually took the time to go over every step with me. You know, I'd had sponsors before, and some were good and some were bad, and, you know, whatever, but no one had ever really sat down with me like he did right here in this very building downstairs, you know, and gone through every step. And that's a first for me, you know, and, you know, that's probably one of the reasons I'm sober today, you know, because I actually had somebody do that with me, you know, someone show me what he had done and how he stays sober. And it's amazing to me. He's a great source of inspiration, you know. I mean, I don't think anybody in this room ever saw him back when I saw him way back in the beginning, but he was kind of a wild man, you know. And I figured, man, when I saw him here, I thought to myself, man, if this guy can get sober and change his life, I can do it too. You know, really. And that's kind of the way it's worked out. You know, he's been real good at taking me through the steps and doing fourth and fifth and, you know, just doing all the to-do things that you need to do, you know, if you want to stay sober. So, anyway, I'm real privileged today to have him as my sponsor, and he's been really instrumental in my, you know, sobriety. I don't think he realizes how much he's helped me. So, anyway, what do I do today to stay sober? You know, first of all, I just want to talk a little bit about the God thing. You know, I had a problem with that when I came around. And, you know, after having been through, you know, what I've been through with the accident and all that, you know, I just didn't know anything. You know whether I could really believe in God or not. You know, but one thing that I haven't had any trouble doing is using the group of drunks, my group, all you people that are show up at every meeting, using those, using you people as a higher power, power greater than myself, however you want to refer to it, good orderly direction. And I also have a lot of faith in what's referred to as the four absolutes. You know, the book talks about trying to live the way that God wants you to live, whatever God there may or may not be. You know, that's a work in progress for me. You know, I'm a lot more open-minded about it today than I have been in the past. I feel like that if those four absolutes, and there's one book I read all the time called 24 Hours a Day, that's part of my daily, you know, readings. And it talks about in there, it talks about a lot about honest, you know, complete honesty, complete unselfishness, you know, complete love, and complete purity. And so I kind of feel like, you know, regardless of the God thing, you know, if I try and latch on to those four, you know, absolute principles, you know, if I do those things every day to the best of my ability, then, you know, I kind of feel like I'm, you know, living the way that God, as I understand Him, wants me to live. So I try and do that, you know, every day, you know, to be as honest as I can, as unselfish as I can, to be as loving as I can be, and be as pure as I can be in my thoughts and actions. That is how I reconcile the God thing for me. You know, like I said, I'm a work in progress. You know, I don't know what part God may or may not have played in my sobriety, but I do know that I have a lot of gratitude, you know, for my sobriety and what this program, you know, has given me. One of the things I do every day, in fact, to stay sober, you know, I have actually five things I do every day to stay sober. And I'm privileged enough to be sponsoring three guys. I think two of them are sitting out there now. Three guys, you know, that I actually sponsored today. And I try and tell them that how important it is to do these five things every day. And, in fact, every time I see them, I ask them about the five things. And it's a real important part of my sobriety. And, you know, the first thing is to ask for help every morning. You know, when I wake up, I ask God to help me stay sober and give me the willingness to do what I need to do to stay sober. The second thing I do is read some literature, whether it's the Big Book or 24 Hours a Day or Touchstones is another one I use, or Daily Reflections, whatever. You know, there are any number of AA-related books that you can use. And the third thing I do is talk to another alcoholic. You know, and when I do that, I'm not talking about who the Braves are playing or what the Falcons score was. You know, I try to talk to somebody, you know, about some AA or some recovery-related topic. And then the fourth thing I do every day is go to a meeting. that's so very important. You know, I hear it said all the time, go to a drinking, go to a meeting. You know, it's been my experience that meeting makers make it. And so I try to go to as many meetings as I can. You know, it's easier for me maybe because I don't work or whatever, but AA has kind of become my job, for lack of a better way to put it, you know. But it's, you know, the best job I've ever had. You know, I've had a lot of jobs, but AA is really one of the best jobs I've ever had. You know, I try and put my sobriety in the first place every day. Sobriety has become my top priority. You know, anytime it's not my top priority, you know, I heard a guy one time tell me that SLIP stands for sobriety and loses its priority. And, you know, you hear about guys going out all the time and they just kind of drift away and they lose touch with the program. So for me, one of the best ways to stay in touch with the program is to go to a meeting every day. And the fifth thing I do is say thanks at night. You know, thanks to God for another, you know, chance at sobriety, and thank you for keeping me sober. That's what I do. You know, I've been through a lot of stuff. I could sit up here and stand toe to toe with anybody in this room with your Uncle Og, and I've been through all kinds of horrible experiences and stuff. You know, my brother died of a drug overdose. My second wife died of a drug overdose, cancer related drug overdose. You know, my cousin died of a drug overdose. So I've had a lot of shit happen, you know, to me. But I feel like as long as I keep doing them five things, you know, the first thing I do too is remind myself every day how powerless I am over alcohol. You know, and I think that you got to do that. They say the first step is the only one you got to do perfectly, and you should do it every day. You know, and there was a time in the past where I always had that lurking notion in the back of my mind that somehow, some way, I would be able to drink like a normal person. And that, of course, never turned out that way. I might have thought I could, but I had to squash that notion. The literature says, you know, you have to squash that notion, smash it, whatever. And anytime I'd ever gone back out in the past, you know, it was because I somehow thought some way that it would be different, you know. And of course, you know, it never turned out to be different. Things only got worse. Every time I went out and drank, got high or whatever, at the end of the day, things were always worse than they were when I started out. So anyway, I guess that's about, you know, my story. I try not to bore you with too many war stories or whatever. Like I said, I could go toe-to-toe with, you know, with anybody in here. So, you know, we're not a glum lot, so I thought I would wrap it up with a little joke tonight. I hope it's appropriate. I hope it doesn't offend anybody. It's actually a joke I heard when I was driving a truck. I used to drive a over road truck, you know, which was kind of ironic, you know, seeing as how my first wife got killed. But anyway, I kind of switched it around so that it would apply to alcoholics. Anyway, it goes like this. There are two guys, they've been friends for a long time, and this one guy kept getting these really bad headaches. You know, and he couldn't figure out why he kept getting these recurring, you know, headaches. And so the other friend tells him, well, man, you should maybe go to the doctor and find out what's going on with you. So finally, after suffering through these horrible headaches, he agrees. So the other guy sets him up with an appointment at the doctor. And so the guy goes to the doctor, and doctor says, well, you know, why don't you check into the hospital and we'll run some tests on you and we'll try and find out what's up, why are you having all these headaches? And so the guy checks into the hospital and undergoes a battery of tests, and stuff. And finally, after 3 days or so, the doctor comes back in the room and says, well, I find out what's going on, man, why you're having these headaches. The guy goes, well, why? What is it? And the bad news is that your normal human brain should weigh 5 pounds, but yours only weighs 4 pounds. So, you know, you need to, you're short 1 pound of brains. And the good thing is that we can fix it. And the guy goes, well, how can you do that, Doc? And so the doctor says, well, for $1,000, I can give you a pound of lawyer brains, you know, and for $10,000, I can give you a pound of lawyer brains. But for $100,000, I can give you a pound of alcoholic brains. And the guy scratches his head and stuff, and he says, well, God, Doc, I can't figure out, now, why do those alcoholic brains cost so much more? And the doctor says, you know how many of them idiots we got to kill to get a pound of brains?
Good job, Mike. Thank you. Where does the time go?
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Promises are real.